This is People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. On this special two-part edition of PTR, we bring you a panel discussion looking at the state of America, where we've been, where we are, and a vision for the future of the country. The panel includes Chicago area housing activist Samir Goswami, Noel Beasley of the Union Unite, attorney Catherine Crawford, student activist Russ Plevachininsky, and member of the National Welfare Rights Union, Sheila Olonaron. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. This fall, a benefit dinner and event was held at the Guild Complex in Chicago in order to raise funds for the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, the newspaper of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. It's often said that without a vision, the people will perish, and a vision for the future was a major component of a panel discussion held at the event. The wide-ranging discussion looked at the state of America, where we've been, where we are, and a vision for the country's future. The panel was moderated by Laura Garcia, editor of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, and the first panelist that she introduced was longtime union activist and member of the National Welfare Rights Union, Sheila Olonaron.
I'm from Flint, Michigan. My parents were two of the millions of African Americans that fled the South and ended up in an industrial city. My father was fortunate enough to gain employment at the GM facilities in Flint and became a member of the United Auto Workers. With that union job and working in UAW, that afforded us many advantages in our society. Around about my 47th birthday, I was kvetching to Beth that I had a problem with my teeth, and I was telling her that, you know, for the first time in my life, I had gotten a cavity. And she was just like, you know, shut up. But part of the reason why was because with that union job, my father had some of the best health care that this country provided for working people. And we were able to have access to doctors, to dentists, to eye doctors, and everything that we needed. And also with enough recreation to read and to pursue interests and activities and hobbies. But let me say a little, let me digress a little bit and make the connection. The auto industry was an auto industry that employed people on a seasonal basis. So that meant that people had to sort of hang around to go back to work. And the reason that it was seasonal was because the work was motivated by the changeover. And the technology was just primitive enough that they had to close the facilities down for about 3 to 4 months to do this massive changeover. They had to stop all the production lines, and hundreds of thousands of workers were sent out, and about a few thousand people stayed in. And you could see the huge gears and the dies that were made to change from one production, from one model year to the next. But they couldn't do it with the production lines working. So in 1947, the state of Michigan enacted what was known as general assistance. And general assistance carried with it a financial assistance as well as medical insurance to provide for these workers that they needed to be a part of the production process. Well, over a couple of decades, that technology began to change. And I witnessed it. It went from hundreds of thousands of workers to where there are less than about 20,000 workers that are still employed in auto production in the city of Flint. In 1992, the state of Michigan eliminated general assistance. 92,000 people were cut from the rolls. 20 people died the first year that this program was eliminated, and a study out of the University of Michigan followed some of these folks and found out that they had increasing healthcare issues for things that were preventable, like hypertension and diabetes and those sorts of things. But the point that I want to make is that from 1947 until 1992, there was some revolutionary changes in technology, in the application of technology to production. And I witnessed that change in my lifetime and the impact that it had on the city of Flint and in the state of Michigan. And so, is there a crisis? Well, for the millions of people who don't have health insurance, absolutely. What does that mean for the rest of the people in the community? Well, if you have a system that is unable to provide health care, then we're all at risk, whether we acknowledge it or not. I work with nurses for the city of Chicago, for the Cook County, for various public and private facilities. But most particularly, the nurses who work for the city of Chicago are responsible for providing public health care. And part of what they are charged to do is to ensure that we don't deal with some sort of huge outbreak of communicable diseases that could be prevented. There are now about 180 nurses who are responsible for the millions of people that live in and around the city of Chicago, and their jobs are under attack every day. These are women who are my age and older, many of them the daughters and granddaughters of sharecroppers, who went to college to get a professional, to become professionals, but also, like, I don't know, there are other people in the room who were brought up as a woman of color. You have a responsibility to your community. If you gain an education, it's not just for yourself. That education is for everybody else as well, and that you're supposed to provide some good in the world. It's not just for your own personal gain. And these nurses are working under conditions where they are not, by any stretch of the imagination, able to do the things that they went into the profession to do. The health department alone this year has taken a $12 million budget cut. And it's real interesting that at the same time that this budget cut has occurred, that they've used $12 million to create a department on bioterrorism. Many reports say that 40-something million people are now without health care insurance. There was a study just conducted out of Emory University Medical School that says that there are some 60 million people in this country without health care. And they talk about the uninsured in families and the cost that this has for families. Because, for example, if you have a medical bill, the entire family then becomes involved in that process. It affects everyone's standard of living. And so the leading cause for bankruptcy is because of outstanding medical bills that people are not able to pay. So is it creating a crisis? Absolutely. Well, what about change? Well, let's talk about that. And I think the question is there a possibility for change? Oh, absolutely. But I think the more fundamental question is, change to what? There are a lot of ideas out there that come from these major media outlets that Lauda spoke of earlier, whose ideas are based on what is happening for them already. But there has to be another idea out there about change. And so, do we want a change that says, well, if you're poor, you should be sterilized so that you're not contributing to the problem? Do we want a change that says, if you're poor and you're not able to provide for yourself and you do something that's illegal, like trying to get assistance from the system illegally, that you should be incarcerated? Well, there are those ideas out there. But in talking about the need for a change, we need to talk about how does this happen, because new ideas need to be introduced. And that's one of the things that the People's Tribune, Tribunal del Pueblo, does, is it looks at how do we begin to look at our society in a way that's going to change it so that these crises that we're constantly facing come to an end once and for all. Healthcare is tied to all of the other crises and issues that we're facing in our society, absolutely. It has an impact on us individually and personally. It has an impact on the community and our society. It has an impact on the people who work in the healthcare industry. And we can't even begin to imagine what kind of havoc will be wreaked when the healthcare system is so decimated and they're not sufficient workers, they're not sufficiently trained, and everything is motivated by profit. But I will say this. I see these times as times of change where the future of our society does hang in the balance. We can go one way or the other. This is a time for those that are bold and for those who understand that a new idea needs to take hold and we must step out. We have a responsibility to do that. And I think that, you know, I'm a mother. I have a kid in college. I pay a mortgage. I have a car. I mean, I'm like everybody else. I'm from the Midwest. I grew up eating Midwestern values. But something strikes me about what is going on in our world. And I think all of us are just like everybody else, but something strikes us. And I think that the average person can understand what these changes are and what's happening in our society. So if someone like me can read the words in the PTTP and have the words in this paper resonate, and I think that anybody else can read those words and have them resonate as well. And I want to conclude with a passage from the papers, from the pages of the PT. And it says, "We offer our pages as a vehicle for the new ideas rooted in our reality and to be the voice of revolutionaries who seek to raise the consciousness of society. Let us gather our collective experience, intelligence, and commitment to bring forth a vision that changes America into a society by the people, of the people, for the people. The times call for nothing less.
Next up was housing activist Samir Goswami.
Quick question for you. How many of you have read the People's Tribune? One issue. How many of you read, say, The Nation or The Progressive? So here's my problem. When I was thinking today about what to say, I thought these are people who probably read The People's Tribune. These are people who probably read The Nation or have some common sense in them. So what can I say to them that's going to be any different than what you read about and what you already know? That was my struggle this morning. I mean, I could sit here and I could stand here and I can tell you about that. There are about 500,000 people that in Illinois that struggle to pay rent every month. There are about 200,000 homeless people in Illinois. I could say that there are about 22,000 children who are homeless in Illinois. But you already know all that, right? We all know that there's a crisis in housing and homelessness, right? I can tell you that I went to Cook County Jail to the women's divisions about 3 months ago, and I talked to some of the women there. And I can tell you their stories, that I met women who were homeless, who had got busted for a misdemeanor offense and now are spending some time in jail. And the women that I talked to were afraid of leaving jail, which I was like, you're in jail. Why would, you know, don't you want to leave? But they were afraid. Why were they afraid? Because the only option when they got out would be, I'm going to have to go to a homeless shelter. I'm going to stay on the streets. I'm going to have to go back to an abusive partner so I don't have to be on the streets. Or I'm going to have to end up in prostitution just so I could survive. Or just so I could feed an addiction that I can't get treatment for. But, you know, you all know that. We all know that. You know, there have been millions of studies about that have been published, you know, year after year. Recently in Chicago, we've had 3 studies in the last 6 months telling us about the plight of women and men in Cook County Jail. I can tell you about the guy I met about 2 months ago who was panhandling on State Street. And I started talking to him and asking what his story was. And his story was a very common story, that he worked at a factory on the south side of Chicago for 12 years. He did it right after he got out of high school. He got the job, $15 an hour, great benefits. He had a family. He was married. He had kids. Then he got laid off. He got laid off because the industry moved south. And since he was doing the same thing for 15 years, he could not find another job. After 3 months, you know, he lost his house. He lost his family, all kinds of troubles. He went to a day labor agency. And the first day, the day labor job, what did they do? They sent him back to a similar factory doing the same thing, but now he's making $5.15 an hour with no benefits, and he has no idea if he's going to come back tomorrow. So, and that is the reality of homelessness in Illinois. But once again, we all know all that because we hear about it every day. You know, nowadays, we even hear it on NBC 5 and on Channel 7 in the news. There are stories about that, but nothing is being done. To be perfectly honest, I'm tired of hearing those stories. And I'm equally as tired of hearing, you know, the rhetoric that we have about corporate accountability and the subversion of democracy, as I am tired about watching CNN and hearing some expert tell us that there is a clear and present danger from Iraq and we have to go in right now and take care of the situation and depose Saddam Hussein and regime change. I'm tired of all that rhetoric because we know all this stuff. We've known it for years. The People's Tribune's been publishing for years, as is Streetwise and other magazines and newspapers. So I wanted today to talk about some things that are happening. Because, A, I personally struggle with negativity. I mean, how couldn't? It's hard not to struggle with negativity and being negative all the time when every time you wake up, you hear bad news. Every time I go to work, I hear about homelessness and women in prostitution and child abuse and things like that. So I thought I'd focus on what we are doing. Well, about 3 months ago, the Balanced Develop Coalition had a 1,000-person march, and they marched on City Hall, and they demanded that Mayor Daley do set-asides for developers so that we have more affordable housing in the city. Many of you were probably there at this march. It was a great time. There were a bunch of kids. It was a beautiful sunny day, and it was very positive. I can tell you that Housing Justice Now, which is a campaign run by the Statewide Housing Action Coalition out of Chicago, has held 4 hearings. They've worked with the legislative body in Illinois to hold 4 statewide hearings on housing. And the beautiful thing is, I've been to every one of these hearings, is that people from all walks of life, homeless people, religious leaders, faith-based communities, business people, Metropolis 2020, banks, have all come together. Activists have all come together and have had these 2-3-hour hearings in 4 different regions of the state to talk about housing. And right now, by the end of this month, they're going to come up with a plan and a report for the next governor of Illinois, which is going to say, this is what you have to do to address housing issues in Illinois and homelessness in Illinois. And many of you were probably at that hearing as well, at those different hearings. I can tell you that the It Takes a Home to Raise a Child housing campaign, sponsored by the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, just met with Rod Blagojevich's people. We met with his chief policy person, and we met with his PR person, his chief PR person. And there was a lot of rhetoric in that meeting, but I think that we came out with a sincere promise from his campaign that once and if he gets elected, they're going to sit down with housing activists within by the end of the year. Sit down with them and not just talk about what the issue is, but talk about implementation of what we need to do to solve the housing crisis in Illinois. Illinois does not even have a Department of Housing. There is no standing committee in our government that is dedicated to solving or even addressing the housing needs of Illinois citizens. We're 49th in the nation for affordable housing. We're one of the worst states in the country on affordable housing as a state. But Rod Blagojevich did make that commitment. Jim Ryan, 2 days ago, was interviewed by the Decatur Herald in Decatur, and he issued a statement that housing and homelessness, actually it was very good. He said homelessness and affordable housing in the same sense. Says affordable housing and homelessness are a critical issue in Illinois, and we have to do something about it. Now, I say all this because the issue has existed forever. We've talked about it forever, but finally, I feel that we are all getting together, that there is a lot of momentum in the state of Illinois and in Chicago to actually do something about it. We've had these hearings that are going to come up with a great report, and Rob Blagojevich, if he gets elected, says that he will do something about it, as does Jim Ryan, if he gets elected, says that affordable housing and homelessness is a huge crisis in Illinois and we have to do something about it. So I feel personally, despite my negative nature, that there is a lot of hope. Now many of you will say, Samir, you're being naive, which I probably am. I mean, you could say that, you know, thousands of people have rallied against the war, but the resolutions to use force just got passed. You know, but I'm going to hold out because I see that, you know, many of you have been out at the rallies and the actions, and we're seeing people from all walks of life, businesses now realizing that they have to start paying their workers so they can retain their workers. You know, the Department of Human Services releasing reports that say, you know, we're spending way too much money after the fact, after someone's become homeless. We've got to think about prevention. So people are just, the issue itself is coming out. I also want to read today a quote by Audre Lorde in an essay she wrote quite a few years ago, called The Master's Tools Cannot Dismantle the Master's House. And the quote is, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us temporarily to beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about change." And she's right. You know, the system is flawed, to say the least. As you all know, the system is screwed up. The deck is stacked against us. But I feel that we all have learned to play that game. And we're starting to master that game. All of us here have used the media, independent media or corporate media, to get our message out, and the message is getting out. All of us have become experts at lobbying, at writing letters, at using the internet and email to mobilize people. And that's why we have thousands of people demonstrating across the world against the WTO, against globalization, and what it could bring if it's not checked. We've done all that, and we are slowly getting to it. The other thing that gives me hope is the other day I was talking to a woman I've known for a couple of years now. She was involved in prostitution for 20 years. She fled home when she was 11 because her stepdad was sexually abusing her. And at the age of 14, she became what's called an exotic dancer in Milwaukee. An exotic dancer, you're 14 years old, people are paying to see this. And she told me, Samir, I was involved in prostitution for 20 years and never once did I think, every time I turned a trick, never once did I think I was going to come out alive. For 20 years, she's turning 5 tricks a week, and every time she thought she was going to be killed. And that's what she lived through for 20 years, and she made it. And she says, Samir, it's a miracle I'm alive, but if I can make it, everyone else can make it. You know, so they're going to keep, you know, Bush is going to do what Bush is doing. He's going to fight a war. The state of Illinois is going to keep cutting funds for human services, but that's okay. Because we're still going to be here, we're still going to fight back, we're still going to figure out how to beat them at their system. We're doing research, we're on the streets, we're out there, we're making noise, we're using the media. So I have a lot of hope of what's going to happen. Now, is this an America I want to live in? Well, I'm an immigrant. I got off the boat 10 years ago, and I'm glad to be here. You know, I'm from India, and there are a lot of problems in India, as there are here. But this is an America I want to live in, because you all are here tonight. I'm going to be in action on Monday, where there'll be 100 people, hopefully, to rally against homelessness. And that's what I'm going to talk to women in prostitution again. We're going to tell me that, you know, we made it. We can all make it, no matter what the odds are. So I am hopeful. And this is the America I want to live in, because no matter what they do to us, we're still here and we're going to keep fighting for it.
You're listening to a special two-part edition of People's Tribune Radio, a panel discussion addressing the topics of America, where we've been, where we are, and a vision for the country's future. This program was recorded at a benefit held for the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo newspaper at the Guild Complex in Chicago, Illinois. The program was moderated by Laura Garcia, editor of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo newspaper, and the next panelist she introduces is Attorney Catherine Crawford.
I think as each speaker speaks, we should remember their message and what they have to say, because it's very important to remember. I mean, Sheila spoke about the crisis in healthcare. Samir is talking about the crisis in homelessness. It is a shame that children, families are living on the streets and in the parks, especially as winter is coming in. But there is hope because we are here. With this, I would like to introduce Catherine.
When I got asked to speak tonight, I was really flattered and honored and sort of awed by it. And when we started talking about what the topic was, I thought I could, you know, speak to y'all for about 3 days on the juvenile and criminal justice systems and how race and class factor into it and what state those systems are in. And so narrowing it down to 5 to 7 minutes was somewhat of a daunting task. And so if I'm going to try to speak quickly but succinctly, and if I jump around a little bit, forgive me. Part of the reason why I might jump around a little bit is because in addition to preparing for tonight's speech, I've also been preparing for the clemency hearings that are starting next week in Chicago. And the reason that I mention those, although thank God we don't have a juvenile death penalty here in Illinois, and I am going to talk about juveniles tonight because we always want to focus on adults, but the reason I mention those is because I'm going to start out by saying that I think they represent a lot of hope for the state of Illinois, for the country, because for the first time, people, normal, everyday Americans are talking about criminal justice issues in ways that I never thought possible. People are talking about issues of police brutality. People are talking about false confessions. People are talking about the effect of poverty and mental illness on people. People are talking about the possibility of granting massive clemency to 158 people on death row, people who are convicted of doing some pretty horrible things. And not only are people talking about it, but a Republican governor is talking about it and is very seriously considering it. So I find that one fact incredibly hopeful, and I think that what Governor Ryan does can have tremendous impact on the criminal justice system throughout the nation. But I'm here to talk about juveniles. Is this the kind of America that we want to live in? What kind of America are we in? Well, first of all, I think we're in a kind of America that is terrified of our youth. We are so frightened of our youth because the media portrays our youth as these violent, remorseless people who are willing to engage in irresponsible and dangerous behavior regardless of the consequences to anyone. How many of you think that youth crime is up right now? Oh, good. Well, that's usually a myth that everybody thinks youth crime is up. In fact, youth crime is down. Unfortunately, while youth crime is down, we are doing our best to keep it up by criminalizing our youth. We have expanded the types of activities that constitute offenses. We have police in schools right now. And instead of calling your mom or the principal, the teachers call the police officer from down the hall. So when you get into a fisticuffs fight in the yard, and I did a lot, even in high school, I broke my finger on Kristen Graziano's chin. Sophomore year, because I was so mad. Well, if that had been today, I would have gone, not to the principal's office, which I did, not to in-house suspension, which I did, but to the police station right down the street. And then I would have had to go to juvenile court. And people talk about juvenile court as sort of this, you know, but it's juvenile court. It's not adult court. Let me tell you how what it's like to go to juvenile court. You go there, it's a sea of black and brown faces on the benches. You sit there from 9 a.m. You're supposed to get there at 9. The judge takes the bench maybe 9:30, 10 o'clock, depending on the judge. And you're sitting there with your mother, who has to take time off of work, and maybe another kid, or you're in the back in lockup, which we'll talk about in a minute, and you're there for 3, 4, 5 hours. An attorney, oh, there are white people there. They're the judges and the attorneys. Those are the white people that are in the system. And they'll come out and talk to you for about 2 minutes, ask you what happened, and then tell you about the plea that they're willing to give you. And then you go in front of this judge who doesn't ask you your name. Well, actually, he does. He says, are you such and such? And they use your last name, but they're not supposed to. And then he says, you're charged with such and such offense, and how do you plead? And then the lawyer steps in and says, please, not guilty. You know, we want a continuance, whatever. It's a very demoralizing experience. It's not an easy experience to go there, to have to stand behind, hands behind your back. The sheriffs treat you very rudely. They, you know, tell you to be quiet. The public defender doesn't care who you are. I mean, there are very good public defenders, and they're very hardworking, but they're overworked. So they don't have a chance to sit down and get to know you. They just know that you're charged with ag bat with a firearm. That's what they know. And you have 2 priors, or you have 1 prior, you have no priors. So juvenile court is not something simply to, you know, a wink and a nod and you're gone. And usually if you have a case, you go back 3, 4 times. And it's, if you say FU to a teacher, that's considered aggravated assault on a public employee. Aggravated assault on a public employee. I was in court yesterday, and I saw this teeny weeny kid. I mean, when they're shorter than me, we've got something wrong. And this kid was 11 years old. 11 years old. He was charged with aggravated battery to a teacher because when a teacher grabbed him, he jerked his hand away and slapped her glasses off. Why is this child in our criminal juvenile justice system? I don't know.
We end the first part of our special 2-part edition of People's Tribune Radio right here. We'll hear more of this panel discussion, looking at America, where we've been, where we are, and a vision for the country's future in part 2. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with social and economic justice for all. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the internet at www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for part 2 of our panel discussion, America, where we've been, where we are, and a vision for the country's future. Check it.